This is officially episode number one of the Performance Dietitian Podcast. I'm Susan Lopez, and today I'm going to be talking to Steve Smith. Steve is the former dietitian for the Army's 5th Special Forces Group and the former sports performance coordinator and dietitian for the Houston Texans. Today, he's going to be talking to us about what it's like to work with the world's most elite military force and some of the non-traditional dietitian skills he used during that time. I know you guys are going to really enjoy today's episode, so here we go.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here today. So real quick, just run through your bio for us real quick. Tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into dietetics, and then let's talk about your career after that.
All right. So I guess starting at the very beginning, I'm originally from North Texas, kind of North Dallas area. I was a multi-sport athlete in high school. Ended up somehow getting recruited to go out to Appalachian State in North Carolina. Played soccer there for a year. Transferred to Johnson & Wales to go to culinary school. After my first 2 years, basically reapply and get into the dietetics program. That's a part of the culinary nutrition world. It's changed a little bit now. There's two different tracks. But at that point, it was all in one. So did the culinary nutrition piece, got to do a couple internships working as a chef and also working at Appalachian State for Jeff Dillman, developing what didn't really exist at the time, but is now a fully functioning program of nutrition with athletic department there, and then helping out at University of Colorado as I was finishing at Johnson & Wales there in Denver. From there, did my dietetic internship down at Presbyterian Hospital of Dallas. So I went back home for a short period of time. Couldn't really figure out which direction I wanted to go specifically, or couldn't really find the position that I felt would be the best place for me right away. So I actually started sport physiology program at Texas A&M and taught some of the undergrad classes for what they call a PEP course, which is kind of a health and wellness and physical education piece for all the students that are required. And for a semester got poached by Jeff Dillman as he was the director of strength and conditioning at IMG. So went down there for about a year, ended up getting picked up by the Oklahoma City Thunder for a short period of time, worked a bit in private practice in Dallas in the interim between there and 5th Special Forces Group. Was there for just under a year and a half, and sequestration hit, and I was fortunate enough and to be able to get into the Houston Texans about 2 weeks later. I was there for 4 years as the sports dietitian and sports performance coordinator, working both in sports science, developing some of the technology there that we were utilizing tracking wise, and then taking over the nutrition piece from the foundation that Roberta Anding had left. And then as of about a year ago, I've been working for an outpatient sports medicine clinic and adolescent medicine and doing a private practice on my own.
So I definitely want to talk football, but first I want to talk a little bit more in depth about your military experience, if that's okay with you.
Sounds great.
So you were with the Army's 5th Special Forces Group down in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, right?
Yep.
So can you walk us through kind of what the day-to-day of a military dietitian does for Special Operations Group?
I would say it's a little bit different for every service line. So I say from the Army Special Operations in the Green Beret world, it's a little bit different every day, but the same themes kind of come through. We're always, well, the goal is to always be around the guys and be in their space to be able to provide them, timely and meaningful intervention education. So whether that be in the actual team buildings in their team room, trying to work through some planning challenges, or whether it be individual education that was requested, or common themes that were noticed by command that needed to be addressed, down to individuals that had some specific goals, whether it be personal professionals. Some of these guys are, even though they've got a nice long stack of tabs, and some of them want to go to challenge themselves in different selections or different training iterations, like dive school, halo school, advanced land navigation, et cetera, that are pretty physically demanding as well as mentally demanding. So prepping for that. And then, you know, in the weight room with the guys, trying to make sure that, you know, your presence is felt and heard. Sometimes it's a point where if a question is asked and there's no consistent voice around, then another voice creeps in that may or may not be appropriate for what the guy needs, or just doesn't have the context. I was fortunate enough to have a really good crew there that if guys asked questions that were outside their scope, they'd go see that guy right over there. See the beard and the tattoos, that dude.
You know, sometimes clients come to us with these outrageous ideas, you know, or they read something in a news article or saw something on Facebook. Is there a lot of that going on?
I feel like everybody falls victim to a bit of partial information, and also they're inundated by all these wonderful, I say wonderful facetiously, influencers that are everywhere. And it's, you know, you can have enough information to be dangerous without truly being educated, which is a challenge. And honestly, the guys that I worked with were extremely savvy, but even with that ability to synthesize information, would fall victim to things that sounded logical but didn't quite work in human physiology terms. So yeah, there were some things there that had to be addressed. I mean, you can take partial information that doesn't apply to you and apply it to yourself and cause some problems for yourself performance-wise or sustainability-wise. But at the end of the day, it could fit somewhere. You just have to figure out how it fits and why they went that direction, really. So yeah, we had quite a few of those. I spent a fair amount of my time dispelling myths more than anything else on the front end, and then being able to figure out, you know, in that process, why they went that direction, why that information was sought out in the first place, and be able to address it with appropriate information that would work for their individual needs.
And a lot of these guys, I mean, how did they take that information? You know, sometimes it's hard for people to, you know, they'll ask for our advice, and then when we give them our advice or give them our recommendations, there can be a lot of resistance there. So knowing that these guys are maybe very, and I'm just guessing, maybe just very type A personalities or just very, I guess, alpha personalities, like how did they take your advice? Were they pretty receptive, or was there some work you kind of had to do there to gain their trust and show them, hey, I really, you know, I know what I'm talking about?
Oh, you had a hell of a guess. They are the alphas. I mean, the special operations community, as far as the SF guys, the guys that are actual special forces, the guys that are Navy SEALs, combat controllers, PJs, JTACs, all these guys have a very different mentality than other soldiers, other civilians, you name it. They have a very different drive, and they will test you. I think one of the biggest things is a lot of them don't necessarily care where you've been. You have a bit of built-in buy-in if you've been some cool places and you've got a good story. But then at the end of the day, they don't really care if you can't hold up to their questioning. I mean, their job is to develop human intelligence at the end of the day. That's a core piece of how they operate, because that is absolutely one of the most valuable things that they can work with. So they're going to do that to you, whether you realize it or not. They're going to figure out whether you can be trusted. They're going to test you. So I had to go through that for a bit. You know, you have a couple strong conversations with guys that will curse at you, yell at you if they think you're wrong. And as long as you can hold your own and have a strong enough personality with good, solid information, not misrepresent it or absolute outright lie, if you don't know something, being strong enough and confident enough to say, I don't know, but I can find out for you in that instance. I know where it works here, but that's not quite what you're asking. So let me go take a look through the literature, look through some application stuff, think through it, and then let me give you the best way that this can work. So you have to prove yourself on that side. And for them, I think a mark of being able to do that confidently allowed me to navigate relatively well. If you come out and say no first, if that's the first word out of your mind or out of your mouth, you're pretty much shut off. So it's in the Green Beret world specifically, it's a lot of operating in the gray, for lack of a better way to put it. It's a don't tell me no, tell me how mentality. So it's how do we figure out where we can get away with some things that may be on the fringe from a nutrition standpoint of like maybe some of these Wazoo ideas can work in this context. One of the biggest things, no matter where you go, whether it's with elite athletes or special operations guys or really any civilian, you're going to have some inherent buy-in based on where you've been, a bit of your experience and the information that you're giving, as long as it's concise, appropriate, and well-packaged. But with those guys specifically, whether you like it or not, you're going to be a part of that like intel collection, and they're going to go through their own internal algorithm to figure out whether you're going to be trusted or not. A lot of the guys initially will come in and try to validate some of the ideas they think are correct. And if you can approach it appropriately, and when I say appropriately, it's in my mind figuring out why that information was sought out, and then figuring out how they were going to apply it, because the information may not be incorrect, but the way that they're applying it may not be the most appropriate, it may not be the most effective. So sometimes it's about giving them a more efficient way to do it. Sometimes it's about correcting some of the inaccuracies in the information where they got a piece of it, but not the whole picture. And then telling them, how like some of their potential theories could work in isolated areas. And then educating as to how or why some of the other pieces don't quite fit, and giving them a solution instead of just telling them no. They operate in the gray, generally speaking. Because there's their operational capacity, their training, a lot of their mission sets don't exactly fit within the norm that most people would consider for like big military operations. They're a bit on their own, and they're directing a lot more than just themselves. So the level of thinking is way out there in a lot of cases compared to most. So they're going two or three steps down the road before you've even finished your statement sometimes.
And these guys, I mean, they're not just alpha males. I mean, these are some really intelligent guys. So for people who don't know, to get into the Army, you have to take a test. And then to get into special operations, you have to score extremely well in that test in certain categories. And these guys are usually the cream of the crop. So I think it makes a lot of sense that they're going to kind of test you to see whether or not they can trust you. And also, I think it makes perfect sense that, they're going to be in a lot of life and death situations for better or for worse. So as a part of their team, I think they have to trusting of you, because even as a dietitian, a lot of the things that you're going to do are going to have an effect on whether or not things are going to go good or bad downrange.
Yeah, you have the opportunity to impact them positively or negatively with every interaction that you have. And sometimes the most negative impact you could think of is kind of your indifference, and therefore they just kind of go out on their own and seek out information. So trying not to be that person is huge. I mean, they're essentially every time they squeeze that trigger, the thought is, are you killing one or creating 10? And so it's the ability to think beyond just the pull itself, which a lot of times people think is the only thing that's happening, but being able to think second and third order effects to every action that's taken. It's something different from most, and it's just something that they're specifically equipped for based on their training. I mean, it's pretty impressive the depth and breadth of the training that they go through, much like the rest of the special operations world, just different in primary mission set.
So as a dietitian, when they're getting ready to head downrange, what are some of the things specifically that you work on with them? that they're appropriately prepared before they even go out there. So in terms of like body composition and what their nutrition looks like, you know, before they go on mission, I know these guys don't really have an off season. You know, they need to be mission ready, you know, at any given time. So how do you as a dietitian kind of fit into that role? How do you prep them to go on mission? What does that look like for you?
Oh boy, big question. So, I guess a couple things first to clarify, so people have at least a little bit of perspective if they haven't been around the Green Beret world very much. And just to be almost purposely vague with it, it's the operation tempo. So basically how the frequency with which they deploy and kind of the training in between is significantly higher than most regular units and even a fair amount of special operations units. Just by numbers. So, I mean, if you're thinking like 4 months deployed, 4 months off, that 4 months off is actually put yourself back together, get your family life back together if you have one, or personal life, and then you're training for the next mission set if there's a specific one, or just training in general to be able to get yourself back up to mission ready. There's kind of a set group of phases to be able to get you back into that, but it takes a lot of work, honestly. The off season, almost like the athletic term, is the biggest misnomer ever, especially in that world. So for them, it's trying to figure out, I mean, you have a security clearance intentionally to be able to deal with a lot of the situations that are there, but also being mindful that you're not going to be cleared to know everything and you don't need to, but the base pieces that are helpful for you are trying to assess, you know, is it a permissive environment or is it a non-permissive environment? Essentially saying, is this a constant hostile environment or is this somewhere where you're in a, you know, friendly country for whatever training environment or transition, whatever the case may be. It could be all sorts of different scenarios. And then with that, is there a potential for an elevation or temperature change based on time of year that you're deploying, hemisphere that you're deploying to, your mission set being X number of days, weeks, months away from an installation or like a downrange base? Are you going to have resupply that's reliable, or do you have to figure out, do you have to learn how to barter and prepare food on your own? It's working through a lot of basic performance needs, but then also looking at it from a operational safety standpoint. So if guys are procuring meats that are, or meat, produce, you name it, if they're procuring goods that are consumed downrange, do you know how to look for needle marks? Do you know how to look for contamination in foods? Can you assess animals appropriately to see if they're fit for consumption? Is there anything that's going to actually harm you in the process of just trying to sustain yourself nutritionally that you can prevent? So a lot of it's, you know, kind of that medical operations safety piece that you're in a very unique place to be able to impact and just educate on how to look for some of these pieces with the help of a lot of times your medical officers and your 18 deltas, which are your medics at the unit, to help kind of fill the gaps where they understand downrange or in a team setting a bit more than you may.
So you're really taking food safety to a whole new level. It's not just the typical serve safe food production, kitchen operation stuff that a lot of dietitians deal with.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, it's kind of the one of the pieces that you take into account is consistency of movement and are you predictable and do you go to the same place to purchase meat or produce sometimes? You know, we might take it for granted here, but if you go to the same place at the same time on the same day, weeks on end, guys that are trying to come after you are going to find you, or guys that are trying to find alternate ways to be able to impact you can find that sometimes in the way of food alterations or contamination, sometimes in physical violence. So you have to understand that nutrition is also in the context of safety, and safety being bodily harm and ultimately mortality at the end of the day too. And not just, hey, we need performance, but also you have to understand the failure points that they're going to have to consider to try to minimize the burden of planning, or at least contribute positively to their planning process.
So, you know, if they're procuring goods or produce from marketers locally, is it almost safer to try and bring what they need?
It would be potentially ideal to be able to bring as much as you possibly could, but the feasibility of that, depending on your mission set, that may just not be possible based on the length of time that you're away from goods and supplies, or distance, or danger for the route to be able to resupply. So sometimes there is no other option to be able to sustain yourself if you've run out of rations. So you're going to have MREs and LERPs and first strike rations sometimes that all have different compositions to be able to feed individual needs for them. Sometimes winter rations, et cetera, have different calorie content based on need for environment, time of year, temperature, et cetera. But if you run out of that, you have to find a way to make it work, because if you're not nourished, relatively speaking, then you can't operate at the level that you need to stay alive and to complete your mission.
And just for everybody listening, so MREs are meals ready to eat, which is basically a neatly packaged shelf stable meal, for lack of a better term or lack of better words. But and then the first strike rations are really just like a stripped down version of that.
Yeah, and then you have LERPs that are essentially a larger ration for longer range operations or longer movements, and then winter rations that are of higher relative calorie content based on operations that require accounting for energy expended to maintain core temperature.
And then how are these guys, you know, how do guys stay hydrated out in the field? So if you're moving in an austere environment, you can't carry, you know, gallons of water with you. Maybe you're only moving with your pack. How do you address hydration in the field?
So hydration is a constant topic with especially the theater of operations. That's been the primary for a lot of units, especially one that I've worked with, which, I mean, it's no stranger to most people. It's hot, relatively dry, and sometimes occasionally you get a little bit of humidity, but it's pretty rare depending on where you are. And you have some elevation thrown in there. So for us, a lot of the teaching point is, you know, hydration is extra seconds, potentially extra minutes for survival if you have a gunshot wound. Plasma volume is key. So it's trying to give you the best opportunity possible to have enough on the back end within that. But then also, that's more of the simplistic approach. But then these guys train heavily to be able to carry pretty high volumes of weight, knowing that they're not necessarily going to have stuff readily available from a hydration standpoint around. So it's taking products that are oral rehydration solutions, whether it's a commercial product or whether it's the old silver packets that taste like you're drinking out of a salt shaker. There's plenty of applications for a lot of the stuff, and there's some other products that you can use to play the game for rehydration as well. But it's trying to make sure that no matter where they go, depending on their pack out weight dry, that you're giving them the education while they're training and the experiential education with that to know this is what is going to need to be added for X distance or X environment. And then, oh, by the way, if you're out of the range, there's some pretty good hydration testing being done showing, you know, potential deficits based on hydration as a reinforcement for accuracy in doing your job, along with sustainment of, you know, just basic bodily function.
Do you ever do any testing with hydration methods with these guys, kind of while they were still stateside? So doing like urine-specific gravities or anything like that?
So we did not at our location. There was a study happening, or still potentially currently happening, along with education using some of the testing measures at ranges that are more well controlled and a bit more of a static population that has no choice. So you're able to control the environment that's there to be able to give them a realistic intervention right then and there, or at least educate them. You can do some passive education on color of pee, thirst, all these other markers that may not be associated with actual hydration to get them on the right road. But at the time, we didn't do any specific hydration testing, but we did a lot of education in the field and in preparation to be able to go to some of these training iterations, and then provided feedback based on what the result was of the training.
Are there any other kind of unique experiences or maybe things that you did during this time that you can share with us?
One of the most unique was actually creating kind of a training that was to teach guys that in austere environments how to field dress animals in kind of a slaughter and prep class, which there's a good part of the special operations units of the SF guys, the 18 series guys that that have hunted animals for eating in their life, but there's also a pretty good percentage of the population that has never hunted, that just learned how to be soldiers and work their way up and chose that challenge. So for them, I worked with one of the older medics that had been around the unit for quite some time and put together a program for safety evaluation of the animal and then showing how to, you know, physically take it, field dress the animal, cape it, remove the skin, show you how you can use it for other things, being able to, you know, get to your primal and subprimal cuts the most efficient way possible of basically portioning out the animal and preserving it for use in the future or for use right away, and then making it relatively palatable so that it can be taken in without people absolutely despising everything they're eating from an animal they may or may not be used to. And that, alongside with the medic going through and educating on here's what the internal organs should look like, here's what's typical, here's what's atypical. If you see this, this is an absolute no-go. If you see this, it's a question mark. Make sure your adult is evaluating it. And then if none of these things exist, good to go. Prep it appropriately. Make sure it's clean. Follow all these procedures as best you can. And go for it.
So that definitely is a non-traditional dietitian skill.
Yeah, it was a pretty cool experience. I got to go back to that side. So a little bit in the field, a little bit in the kitchen, and a makeshift kitchen in some respects. But essentially, it was life skills for them. So that was a lot of fun. But I got the opportunity to work with a lot of really great dietitians. I just happen to have that niche of the culinary background. But there are a lot of dietitians that kind of operate in the special operations world, or did back when I was there, that were a hell of a lot better as far as experience wise or understanding in different areas and of operations. And I got to learn a ton from them and how to work within the area. And then also thankfully be able to provide my unique skill set to changing our military feeding for the special operations units within the Army to change the standard to fit closely to the USOC's feeding guidelines from what was the old Army standard.
So this is one of the things that I really love about performance nutrition is I feel like sports dietitians are dietitians that kind of sit on the fringe a little bit. So whenever I talk to a sports dietitian, their backgrounds are always super varied. And they always have just sort of these really unique things about them that I feel like sometimes when you're talking to a clinical dietitian or a regular dietitian or an outpatient dietitian, you know, no offense to them. I think they're fantastic. But I feel like sports dietitians, they just have just a whole different mindset altogether.
Mindset's probably a good way to put it. A lot of people would think that we're a little bit crazy and gluttons for punishment, which they're not all wrong. I mean, anybody that's willing to work the hours that you do in a sports setting with the type of things that you have to do consistently and the number of people that could potentially be yelling and screaming at you at any given moment and saying, yeah, sure, I'll do that. I'll sign up for it. We're a little bit different. I think one of the pieces that impacts us all having a bit of a, or a good percentage of us having a bit of a varied path is that we all have to find our way there. You know, when I was working my way into the sports nutrition world, it wasn't very well defined. It was still relatively young. There were a good core group of individuals that had been around for a number of years, but there wasn't a well-defined path to mentor young sports dietitians, and there wasn't a very well-defined path as to how you get to the next level. And so a lot of it was, are you willing to grind? Are you willing to do this weird job or take on these extra skills? Or, you know, you have this added piece of the culinary side, et cetera, that can differentiate you from your peers that are trying to get into sports. And how can you use that to your advantage to work your way into a position that you feel you can be the most impactful? And then a lot of us are almost solely devoted to just doing what it takes to get that job done. We've moved a lot of places and been a lot of places away from home, and place to place. If you wanted to move up at the time, it's a lot different now than it was, but you essentially give up a lot. And so that becomes your identity. So you essentially have all this time that you've dedicated to developing other skills. If you're able to do well in the profession overall, to try to continue to grow and develop.
And I think a lot of the groundwork that a lot of, I don't know if I want to call them OG sports dietitians, but like yourself, you know, you talked about Roberta Anding. I think a lot of that groundwork has really paved the way for a lot of us coming up, just open doors, new opportunities. You're hearing sports dietetics being talked a lot about. You're seeing more colleges bring them on, and now the military really diving into bringing dietitians on as well. So I think that's created a lot of opportunity for dietitians coming up in the field now.
Yeah, there's an incredible group of people that laid the groundwork for us to even have the opportunity to do the job that we do today. I mean, both in civilian and military world, I mean, in the civilian side, there's, whether you like it or not, consultants have their place and will continue to have their place in the sports world overall. And the ability for them to be able to impact sports in the way they did, whether you like it or not, you know, the likes of, you know, the Roberta Andings of the world, Leslie Bonsi, you're talking about, you know, Michelle Rockwell, you're looking at a bunch of different people. You've got guys and gals that have worked on both sides of the fence, whether it be special operations and professional and even Olympic, like Rob Skinner, that's done all three. You've got people in the military like Christy Logan, Karen Daigle, Spence Webb. The list goes on and on. I mean, Ted Harper, Ladd Harris, all these people that have come in, whether a lot of the latter people were about the same time that I came in, similar timelines, but there are a lot of people that opened up the opportunity on the front end to be able to even give us the chance to make the argument that it's going to be impactful. So I feel like a lot of times, and this is more of a soapbox thing for me, is a lot of people disregard or sometimes unintentionally disrespect a lot of what's happened in the past. And like I said, whether you agree with it or not, or the way it was handled, the consultants of the past created the ability for you to have your full-time job eventually. And so I'm very thankful for the people that were ahead of me in different capacities and different places to be able to allow me the opportunity to do what I've loved for, you know, working on 10 years. So it's been awesome.
So really, I still want to talk about football, but I have to ask you this question first. So I want to hear from you kind of a little bit, you know, if there's something, without giving too much information, if there's something that maybe you worked on with someone that made you kind of go, maybe not so much.
You get a lot of weird stuff thrown at you. I'm trying to think of something specific. I had a lot of guys that had personal, I say on the military side, personal aspirations of, like, let's say, athletic achievement on their own. I mean, a lot of those guys were former college athletes, and if they weren't former college athletes, they were just really, really athletic individuals that that went that direction right out of high school or soon after. And so, like, for instance, we had a guy that competed pretty high level of ultra endurance and ultra marathon runners in that running world, and had to stave off or at least give a reality check of some of the nutritional patterns that you're attempting to do and their efficiencies or inefficiencies compared to in your athletic endeavors compared to what your job requires, and making sure that you don't sacrifice your ability to do your job for the other 11 guys on your team, knowing that you have to bring them back just for the sake of doing this fun stuff on the side. So a lot of it was just trying to redirect people. But yeah, I've heard a lot of really weird stuff, supplement-wise and cleanse-wise, and you name what everybody's grandma, aunt, or guru has told them. I think I've lost count and probably been desensitized to a lot of it, to be honest. Which is why I can't think of one that's off the top of my head. But yeah, I get thrown that stuff a ton even today.
So I have to ask you, as a professional, so there was a recent article that was put out, and it was probably going on maybe almost a month ago now, about how the Navy SEALs are looking at using a ketogenic diet for those operators. So knowing that you've kind of worked within the soft community, tell me how you feel about this, or what your opinion is of this.
So my professional opinion of it is that it's absolute nonsense, but really, I mean, not to miss the point of, I mean, it's sensationalized news for sure. And a lot of what it was based on sounds great and maybe something that could work in very small or isolated areas, but applied broadly doesn't make much sense overall, and in my opinion shouldn't be used in a broad sense with especially our special operations guys outside of very, very isolated areas. Like, the premise that you're going to, you know, positively impact a diver with a ketogenic diet, I mean, physiologically, I can't make sense of it. Essentially, you know, when you become fat adapted, you actually become inefficient at utilizing oxygen. So essentially, you're to do the same amount of work, you're having to consume more oxygen when you are fat adapted compared to a normally fed athlete.
So let's kind of put that into context for the people that are listening. So the article that came out, it talks specifically about the ketogenic diet being beneficial for diving, which is what you're talking about. And part of the article stated that the reasoning behind that is because these divers, the way that they're breathing underwater is creating an oxygen deficit, and that can lead to some injury. So specifically, it talked about seizures for these guys. And the reasoning behind running the ketogenic diet, and correct me if I'm wrong, was the article stated that it believed it would keep them underwater longer with less risk of seizures. So that's kind of what we're talking about here. So you're talking about beta oxidation really doing the opposite of what they're stating in the article they're hoping would happen. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I mean, the argument that's being used, and I don't know if it's being, if statements were cherry-picked and misrepresented from the original statements, because it's really tough to figure out if there are ever any full statements referenced in the entire article, even in the original. But if you look at it from an oxygen standpoint within a closed loop system, which the majority of, like, there's only one unit that operates in a mixed gas system, and it's not a combat unit, it's a salvage unit, essentially, but most of them use a closed loop system. But there's an absolute amount of oxygen available, essentially, if you want to stay away from that. And if you're having to consume more oxygen to do the same amount of work, the math just doesn't add up. That actually shortens your dive time if you try to do that math, unless you do less work. I mean, that's the way that I see it from a very, very simple math standpoint. We may be able to play and get into the semantics of some other pieces, but from a base performance standpoint, I feel like that would be negatively affected overall based on what they're presenting as their evidence. I mean, there are studies that are done that are relatively okay compared to the past. I mean, John Ivey ran one that was, like, I believe it was 29 military-esque patients or individuals, participants that were in ROTC in college. So younger than the majority of the dive population, especially in special operations, by about 3 or 4 years when they get into the units. So not really a representative population to begin with, knowing that they're in college, they're free fed, and they're not being trained in the same way. And they actually, the study was set up to be able to give them the potential for the best benefit in the world. And there really was no performance benefit that could be attributed to that fat adapted diet. What they did come up with was that they were able to lose a higher percentage of body fat. So if you think of it from a risk standpoint in the military as a whole, and if their only metric is to drop the body composition of an ever worsening standard of military acceptance, from a fitness standpoint and body comp standpoint, sure, I can buy that. But is that really the way to do it? Are we really that inept to be able to find another way? Are people not able to put this into practice, and so we have to go this route? Because that's really not doing you much good apart from that one isolated way of addressing body comp over an acute time.
So,
and then how do you get out of it? Are we going back into carbohydrate rebound because you haven't educated your people appropriately once they've reached their ideal quote unquote body comp for change? Like there's so many odd circumstances that can come in there that really don't make a whole lot of sense to me to apply that broadly.
So do you feel like there's ever, and maybe they're just doing this, maybe it's just a trend, you know, maybe they're just jumping on the low carbohydrate bandwagon, I don't know. But do you feel like there's ever a instance in performance where a ketogenic, and to be perfectly honest, I'm kind of over the ketogenic diet. I feel like it's been just thrown at everything. But do you ever feel like there's a place where a ketogenic or a very low carbohydrate diet would be appropriate in a setting like this?
So I think before I make the full statement, it's part of it is the key of what the definition of all those actually are and what you're comparing them to. To be quite honest, there hasn't been a standard that's been met across all of the research to be able to say that this is X, this is Y, mm-hmm. from a composition standpoint and control for caloric and energetic needs. So total calories and the macronutrient content of those across the board and being able to show consistent results. So number one, you have to define what all of those actually mean. What is very low carbohydrate? What is low carbohydrate? What's keto? Because people have very different definitions in the public, in the media versus in the research world. And even in the research world, there's becoming a bit better defined areas of those, but still the more research that comes out, the more variation there is as well. So I think the long and the short of it is, in my eyes, there is a very, if you think of periodization models overall, we're extremely sophisticated, or at least we'd like to think so, in the strength and conditioning world, in the performance world, of being able to periodize for potentially, you know, 4 year cycle for Olympics, for instance, where we have all these phases for adaptation based on our training, our volume, our intensity, et cetera, and rest time. But we're essentially black and white when it comes to nutrition. I feel like there's a place, I know there's a place based on adaptation standards from intake for low carbohydrate availability training and recovery. There's a place for high carbohydrate availability training and recovery. Like, we shouldn't look at it so myopically and say we always need carbohydrates, we always need to to pound this down. We always need to have no carbohydrates. Use it for its intended purpose. Look at the training. What is the purpose of the training? Is it for recovery? Is it for adaptation? What stage of the season are you in? What stage of deployment readiness are you in? Where are you? Why are you recommending what you're doing or what you're recommending? And if you can't justify it there, get better. Like, look back, figure out why you're doing what you're doing. Are you doing it because everybody's always done it that way, or because you actually know why the hell you're recommending it?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think there's a lot of rigidity sometimes in the nutrition world. So one of the things that I've heard you say in the past is, you know, it depends. So if someone's asking you a nutrition question where people are just yes or no, and it has to be one way or the other, and there's a lot of rigidity, I think that happens even among dietitians, where they're just set in their ways and they prescribe, you know, one way of eating, you know, across the board. And there's really not enough periodization going on, kind of how you talked about earlier.
We've created this landscape of sports dietitians or people that exist in the sports nutrition community that have essentially become doers out of necessity and have less of the capacity to be an actual sports nutrition practitioner. And so being able to critically think and get through college, because critical thinking is relative to past tests versus application in the real world with timelines and essentially you're dealing with people, which always throws a wrench into things. And then there's money and lives on the line. So I think part of it is that we've created this culture of just doers rather than thinkers, and really taking a step back and figuring out why you're doing what you're doing at what time, for what reason, being able to make an appropriate argument to be able to change it if you need to, depending on the scenario that you're in or the environment that you're in, is really key. And it's not that people are doing it all wrong. It's that there's enough wrong consistently, or enough that's not making things better. You're just putting band-aids on gunshot wounds a lot of times. And I've been guilty of it in the past as well, of, you know, I will jump to a conclusion and then I'll think through it and go, no, I'm an idiot for thinking that.
I think we've all done that. I think, sometimes you just don't know what you don't know.
Well, and part of it too is just because you can do something, does it really mean that you should? Like, can you become a fat adapted athlete? Absolutely. Should you? Does it really make sense? I mean, you can answer that it depends to just about everything, because context is key for sure. In certain areas, it's absolutely appropriate. Sometimes it's beneficial and performance enhancing. Sometimes it's actually detrimental to performance. And so that's a piece that you really have to evaluate. One of the hardest parts for people is you have to figure out what the amount of information that's being thrown out into the public forum in research and otherwise, whether it's peer reviewed or not. You have to be able to figure out at what stage do you have enough confidence to make a recommendation to change what you're doing. And that's, generally speaking, a lot of sports practitioners, even the strength and conditioning world, believe that application is probably 7 to 8+ years ahead of what the research can show us wholly. Does that mean that the research is wrong? No. Does it mean that the application is right? Hell no. But what you're doing is the best that you can for your athletes today without putting them in harm's way. But the temptation to change things with the newest trend, essentially, you know, if you're constantly adding things to your program, how can you possibly believe in everything that you do all the time? Like, your effect is, you know, Louise Burke puts it pretty well. It's the effect in terms of sprinkles versus icing on the cakes. Well, that's great, but have you built the base of the cake correctly? Like, does the cake exist or is it going to fall apart, essentially being the base of your nutrition? The new thing's a sprinkle. Would a sprinkle on a cake without icing be a special? Probably not, right? The cake has to be built correctly, so the base of your nutrition needs to be there. Your periodization and recovery and making sure that you're there is kind of the icing. It's nice addition there. And then the sprinkle is like, maybe we'll throw this in based on this very individual and isolated area. and maybe this is going to give us the half or 0.1% gain that we may be looking for here, because this is the one thing I want to change. But is that what you need to focus on? Probably not. And so it's really cautiously moving beyond being proactive all the time for the sake of being proactive or being innovative, and capitalizing on changes that can be made based on where an athlete is. Because the majority of our athletes, and I say that it's probably in the 80%+ range conservatively, that can benefit from a lot of change that doesn't involve a whole lot of the wazoo weird shit that's maybe going to give you part of a 0.1% gain.
So are you currently doing any, you're not working with the military directly now, but is there any work that you're doing in your private practice with military individuals or people who are looking to get into the military?
So I am in a couple different ways. So like you said, not with the unit directly, not with the military as in an official capacity, but with individuals both in, in private clients from, you know, sometimes I have officers are enlisted that are trying to go from a regular service line, if you want to call it that, or a typical service line into the special operations world, whether that's, Marine Raiders, if you're talking about, SFAS going to the Green Berets, if you're going to be a combat controller, PJ, or a SEAL, essentially. So but I do work with people that are either in the military or outside the military, a civilian trying to take, like, for instance, an X-ray contract to become a Green Beret or drop straight into to Indoc for BUDS.
And the X-ray contract is really just somebody who's trying to get into the military potentially in special operations, but they don't necessarily have a job title yet.
Yeah, so the X-ray is basically go in, and correct me if I'm wrong, because it's likely changed since the original X-ray that I remember. Of the X-ray contract is a civilian that takes a contract as an infantryman or woman now that they go through their basic, their infantry basic, they go through some of their training, and then they'll go straight into SFAS. And if they're selected, then they are put on the docket to go to the Q course. So their time in another unit is generally not a part of the reality for them. So they've chosen to go directly into special operations based on age, athletic ability, et cetera. I'm sure there's a lot of things that I'm missing there, but essentially they're skipping through the process if they've qualified for it to be able to go like fast track through and then be able to train and get into a unit if it's appropriate.
Yeah. So essentially just based on what I know about it is if you're coming into the military and your paper test scores and your physical test scores meet the standard for that special operations community that you're wanting to enter, you are essentially going from being a civilian into the operator pipeline, just as you described.
Yeah, so I work with a few individual clients doing that. Have several in the pipeline for going into basic and dropping in on that side, and then dropping in based on specific timelines for rank requirement for current service members that are trying to go to the next stage or to the special operations world overall. And then I also work with a group of individuals. So Jeff Nichols, former Navy SEAL dev group guy that is an exercise physiologist as well, was an exercise physiologist before he became a SEAL, along with John Sullivan, who's a sports psychologist and works in neuroscience research, along with Stu Smith. He's a Naval Academy grad, former SEAL officer, been around forever, strength coach, and works with, he probably has a high, actually he has the highest selection rate through BUDS to date in recent history. So that crew kind of together, we do some resiliency courses. So we do both for military and those that are trying to move in, along with law enforcement and first responders, where we do some of the mental component with John, the strength and conditioning component with Jeff and Stu, and then with myself on the nutrition side, whether it be what you can call like front seat meal prep for guys that are like law enforcement, for example, that you know, if you're in a car, you're doing one thing and you got to have this stuff available. How can you fuel appropriately based on shift work, managing sleep, managing recovery, managing kind of the big picture there. So a little bit of everything on that side. So yeah, still pretty heavily involved just in the private world as it pertains to, I guess, military training or selection, but nothing in an official capacity.
So if somebody's interested in attending a seminar like that or working with you, where can they find that information?
To reach me, the easiest way is either through my email, it's fuelingperformance4@gmail.com, or find me on Instagram at fuelingperformance. You'll be able to find the information and likely a link to, if it's one of the resiliency seminars, on Jeff's page, for sure. And can go from there. Even if you send me a message on Instagram, I can kind of refer you whatever way you'd like and figure out how I can meet your needs.
So do you have a seminar coming up anytime soon?
We do, August 20th through the 22nd. The four of us are going to be up in, or well, five of us. Jeff Jeffries is actually joining us this time from LAPD. He's coming out to Virginia. We're going to be in Virginia Beach doing a resiliency seminar for 3 days out there. And so I'll have the nutrition component there. We'll have some good pieces from John, Jeff, both Jeffs, I guess, and Stu. Yeah, I'm thankful to be able to learn and play off of each other and develop even while we're there teaching. It's a cool experience for sure for those that get to be a part of it.
If you don't mind, I'd just like to take a second to thank a lot of people that did a heck of a lot more work than I did or contributed as a part of the big team that got a lot of the stuff done during my time and even after I left the military side. So I'm sorry if I forget about you, but it's the best list I could come up with the help of others. So Christy Logan, of course, Major Karen Daigle, Laurel Wentz, Rob Skinner, Major Nick Barringer, Major Sean Spanbauer, Major John Dunning, Lad Harris, Katie Durbin, Cheryl Zonkowski, Christina Strudwick, Ted Harper, and then some of the researchers that were between Usarium and Pennington Biomedical Research are Lieutenant Colonel Asma Bukhari, Lieutenant Colonel Renee Cole, Lieutenant Colonel Aaron Crombie, and Dr. Catherine Champagne. Again, I apologize if your rank is wrong or if I missed anybody accidentally, but a lot of things have changed, and I really appreciate everything you guys did to be able to help me as an individual there, and then also the guys to give back and push things forward. Thanks again for letting me take the time.
All right, guys, there you have it. Steve Smith imparting his knowledge upon us. If you did not get anything out of that episode, then you probably weren't listening very well. Steve is going to be joining us again to talk about his time with the Houston Texans, so I hope you guys will tune in for that. If you have a question or comment that you would like played on an upcoming episode, be sure to use the link in the show notes to leave a voice message. You can also email me at susan@performancerd.org. If you are a performance dietitian and you would like to be featured in an upcoming episode, please also reach out by email. That was officially episode number one in the books, guys. So if you enjoyed it and you liked it, please be sure that you check us out on Instagram at @PerformanceRDPodcast and that you share it with your friends. See you next time.